None of you are alive. You're all dead. You're all dead. You're all dead! Can't you feel it? You're all dead! You're all dead! You're all dead! You're all dead! You're all dead!
Yeah, kind of like your career.
It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered a streak!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat! Delete!
You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
December is here. This is the first December sound of here. December 3rd. Sunday, December 3rd, 2017. This is episode 524 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off. I am the Sala Monster. It also means that we are in the home stretch here for Audible, our final month of the year for sign-ups for the free trial. Hopefully we can end on a high note here. Audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. You can sample the service for 30 days, get yourself a free audio book. Just plug that link in and take advantage. Audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Could also become a VIP supporter, PayPal VIP, if you'd like to, on thesalamonster.com. You'll see the link on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out, or as Anthony on Twitter said the other day, a PayPal donation of $10,000 or more will get you a nickname, a shout-out, and a month of guest hosting the Sound Off. Yeah, if you didn't see that, I found out this week that my insurance company said that my recent hospital stay was medically unnecessary, and they won't pay for any of it, so they're sticking me with a bill for over 10 grand. So now I'm in the process of appealing this thing, and I've got doctors writing letters to explain to them that, in fact, it was medically necessary, and we'll see what happens. I mean, I'm not gonna hold my breath on them reversing their decision, at least not this first go-around. I have a feeling the referee's decision is going to be final on this one. And, you know, I got to tell you, I'm getting real sick and tired of fighting with insurance companies. You know, over the summer, I had a fight with one because they refused to authorize a test from my mother. My mother's doctor said, look, I want to send you for this test. It's a scan. And they refused to authorize it. They said, no, it's not needed. And I can't tell you how long that went on for. I mean, she could have died in the time that it took to get that whole thing resolved. I was on so many conference calls with her on one line and the insurance company on the other line. And they never did approve her for that test. Through all the fighting and all the, oh, we sympathize and all this other garbage. You know, they never did authorize that test. But you know what they did? This is the wildest thing. The morons they are. This is what they did. They approved her for 3 individual scans. Instead of just authorizing the one, which would have tested for everything, all these different parts of the body, they said, no, we want you to go for this part of the body, and this for this part of the body, and then this for this part of the body. So instead of just paying for one test, they paid for 3. And it ended up costing more than what the cost of the other scan would have been. Explain that one to me. It's a good thing we got those results too, especially, you know, we had to recalibrate the treatment plan and all that. So this is the type of bullshit that I've had to deal with this year with insurance companies. You know, they think they know better than the doctors do. And, you know, if we're so worried about how Jason Jordan might do when they turn him heel, just put him in a suit and tie and give him an insurance CEO gimmick. He'll be the biggest fucking heel on the roster. Anyway. We had a few first-time donators this week, which is always really cool to see. John Luz Cannon Lopez, thank you very much. Deadpool James Herrera, same to you, my friend. Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Masgrave Micah Harshaw, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Left Hook Luke Hyams, the Australian Ass Kicker Anthony Patty, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Aim for the Head Andrew Jorlog, Gabriel the San Diego Beer Snob Solis, still one of the more creative names. The Chin Crusher, Karsten Axe, John, More Money, More Problems, Morin, The Malaysian Mastermind, Samuel T, Midnight Menace, Nick Knotts, Demolition Man, Donovan McIntosh, Clayton, Creepy Uncle Van Kockenstein. I take that back from what I said before. That probably is the most creative name that I've heard. Loudmouth Lucas Pritchard, Rambo Apocalypse, Dave Wilson, Loudmouth, I mentioned Loudmouth already, Lucas Pritchard. Now you get two shout-outs. Texas Hangman, Michael Hanna, Zach the Mac Gentry, what's up, Zach? And Matthew Moneybags Morocco, who just turned 21, which means now he can drink. Now that he can drink, it should make it a little bit easier to sit through Raw on Monday nights, especially after that snooze fest from last week. And a shout-out to David Beddoes as well, listening over in the UK. So thank you to everybody. And hey, check out ProWrestlingLinks.com. It's a great website. It's a great little one-stop shop for all your, all the big pro wrestling websites and podcasts are all listed there. They're all indexed there. So that's ProWrestlingLinks.com. Go check that out. Thank you to everybody who's been tweeting me images of you voting in the Wrestling Radio Awards. I appreciate that. Yeah, do it at your own leisure. Again, it's a fun little thing. And, you know, for me, it gives me a chance to plug those two interviews that I did again earlier this year. There's the category for Show of the Year. You can nominate us for that, just write in the name of the show. But there's another category for Male Interview of the Year. And there were two interviews that I really enjoyed doing, and I thought they were very insightful. There was one from March with Dave Lagana, former WWE writer. He also worked for TNA for about 5 years. Now he's working on this project, which I'm actually going to talk about here in a second, with Billy Corgan, or I guess it's William Patrick Corgan. But it's a fascinating interview. I think we went almost 90 minutes with that one. So that's up on YouTube. Check that interview out. You can nominate that as an Interview of the Year candidate if you would like to do so. Or the interview that I did with Justin Roberts, which I also enjoyed. I think that was back in July. And we talked about a lot of his run, but also a lot of the inner workings of things behind the scenes in WWE and, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, all that stuff. You know, I thought it was a good mix and very insightful. So it's a great chance for me to kind of bring those up again and remind people who may not have heard them to go back and check that out. And you can nominate those for Interview of the Year if you would so choose to do so. I want to say a few words about the NWA project that Lagana and Corgan have been spearheading now for a number of months, because I've really been digging these videos on their YouTube channel, and I feel kind of bad because I haven't really been talking about it, but I've been following along and I've really enjoyed it. And just the way that they have tried to build up Tim Storm as this throwback to the days when the NWA champion was the champion who would travel to all of the different territories all throughout the country and defend his title. Now Tim Storm's an older guy. He's in his, at least early, if not early to mid-50s. For a guy, you know, who's, you know, up there in years, I don't want to make him sound old, but, you know, he looks great. Actually, if you see images of him from earlier in his career, it's like, I don't know, to me it looks like night and day. Maybe it's the mustache, maybe because he doesn't have a mustache anymore. Because he's been wrestling for a number of years, you know, and I guess more so in the Midwest and sort of the southern areas, he was more well known, not so much in other parts of the country. But, you know, he's a grade school teacher by day, NWA champion by night, knows that he's at the tail end of his career. He's enjoying every second of it. They've done a bunch of personality profiles on him. We've gotten to know his family a little bit. Really cool stuff. And, you know, but he's been defending the NWA title in promotions all over the country. You know, Tommy Dreamer invited him to a House of Hardcore show recently. He made an appearance there. He'll be at the CZW Cage of Death show next weekend. They extended the invitation to him to come. I just love the way they're working this. You know, they're really going old school with this. And he's got this feud going. I gotta talk about this. He's got this feud going with this guy, Josephus, I believe is how you pronounce his name. If you've been following the 10 Pounds of Gold video series on the NWA YouTube channel, you know all about this guy. He and Storm had a match not too long ago, and they're about to have another one. So they're really hyping this up, the big rematch. And so Josephus, in one of the videos that they uploaded, he went to the recording studio where Corgan was in the middle of a recording session. And it shows him sort of waiting outside, and he's sitting there just cutting a promo, waiting for Corgan to you know, come out of the studio. And he, you know, demands a title shot. And he's claiming as he's sitting there, you know, waiting for Corgan and cutting this promo. And he's a very laid-back, calm, kind of creepy guy. He doesn't shout. You know, he's not that kind of personality. But he's sitting there, and he's talking about their first match, how, you know, Tim Storm caused 3% vision impairment in his left eye. I'm like, 3%? 3%? Wow. You know, it's like, I'm watching this video, and the comments, there's one comment underneath the video. It's this one guy, he's like, you know, I'm going to call into work on Monday and use that as an excuse, you know, that I have 3% vision loss in one of my eyes. I haven't tried that. I might try that myself. But I've just been enjoying, you know, the hell out of these videos. They're very well done. They're very, you know, well shot. It's the sort of thing that Lagana and Corgan were using their 30 Days series on YouTube for as something of an experiment. If you remember when I talked to Lagana on my show, he talked about that, how that whole 30-day series following Billy around different parts of the country, it was like one long road trip that they took over the course of well, obviously 30 days. But it was a prelude to doing similar stuff in that same vein. You know, they wanted to see how they might be able to apply that sort of concept to pro wrestling. He couldn't really get into a lot of detail with me at the time, but to see, you know, to kind of see that now put into action is really cool because I think it's working. You know, I mean, look, there's more people, you know, kind of chattering now about the NWA than there probably has been in 25 or 30 years, in all honesty. I mean, I know the NWA has been a thing. It never really went away, but it doesn't have the cachet. It doesn't have the prestige that it had. And I don't know that it ever will, honestly. I don't think you can ever sort of go back to those days. But they're doing their best to, you know, make it relevant again and just give some people something fun to follow along with on social media, and I think it's been very effective so far. You know, I even see some people in our group on Facebook, you know, posting about it here and there, and really digging the videos as I am. So if you haven't been following along, I suggest you give those videos a look. Like I said, the NWA isn't what it used to be. I think, you know, Billy Corgan is trying, because, you know, he's been a wrestling fan for much of his life, and I think him doing this, he's trying to restore some of that, which I think is a noble thing for him to try and do. He's making a hell of an effort just to try to get back some of that luster that it's lost over the years, and I think he's doing a commendable job with it so far. Cody Rhodes and the Young Bucks announced their plans to self-finance what would be the biggest independent wrestling show ever held, and try to sell out a 10,000-seat venue sometime next year. This all stems from a Twitter exchange, because that's where all of these things start now. It all starts on Twitter. But it started in a Twitter exchange back in May between Dave Meltzer and a fan. You know, fans will tweet Meltzer and he'll respond to them. He'll quote tweet them sometimes. And they asked him, you know, look, do you think Ring of Honor could sell out an arena with over 10,000 people? And Meltzer correctly tweeted, not anytime soon. I don't know why some people got so bent out of shape about that answer, because Ring of Honor has, in fact, never sold 10,000 tickets to an arena show. He is not wrong to think that it would be a while before something like that happened, because Ring of Honor has been around for over 15 years, and in those 15 years, they've never even come close to doing that, or they've never tried, which they would have if they felt that they could do it. There's a reason that they haven't. In fact, they set their all-time attendance record, because I thought I remember reading that they set their all-time record around WrestleMania earlier this year, so I looked it up, and they did. They set their all-time attendance record earlier this year, WrestleMania weekend, 3,600 people. That was for a show, that was actually the show that was headlined by the Broken Hardys against the Young Bucks in a ladder match, okay? 3,600 is a far cry from 10,000. Point being, I see some people shitting on the guy, or I did at the time, you know, for making a perfectly reasonable assumption. Anyway, Cody Rhodes saw this. This was back in May. Cody Rhodes saw this. He responded back to Dave and said, I'll take that bet. I didn't know he was making a bet, but Cody said, I'll take that bet. Now they're putting their money where their mouth is. They are self-financing their own show, I guess because Ring of Honor didn't want to go in on it with them. They're looking at different cities right now. Nothing's been announced. Cody was on the Busted Open show on Sirius XM this week. He said that his dream main event for that show would have him defending the Ring of Honor title against Daniel Bryan. Now, I do think that if they want a lot of people to show up to this thing, they're going to need a big main event. And Daniel Bryan's first match back, let's assume it is, it would be his first match back in, what, 3 years? 3.5 years? Wrestling for the championship that he once held? That'd be a real nice hook. I don't think it's enough to sell 10,000 tickets. I don't think it's that kind of a hook. I mean, even if they load that show up with other ROH names, I would have to think Ring of Honor would be like, yeah, you know, they would allow some of their guys to be on the show. You know, and who knows, maybe they could get some New Japan names, you know, if the Bucks pull some strings, maybe Kenny Omega. Kenny Omega would be a big get for them. He's hot right now. I still don't see it happening. Even if they could do all of those things, I think they'll have a nice crowd. I think, are they going to make money off it? I don't know. I don't know how much they're spending. I don't know how much they're investing here, you know, the Bucks, but they're spending their own money. I don't know if they'll recoup all of it, if they'll make a profit, or if their only goal here is to get X number of people into that building so they could win the bet. I don't see them being able to get 10,000 people. I think it's really cool that they're trying this. I commend them for it, but 10,000 is a big number. You know, even WWE has trouble packing 10,000 people into some of the buildings that they run these days. I mean, you've seen those photos from the SmackDown tapings. You've seen those photos from some of the SmackDown house shows. It's pathetic. And that's from a company that has television on the USA Network. 2.5 million people, 3 million people watching the shows every single week. This is a company that makes millions of dollars, hand over fist. So I think, you know, without a brand, it's not even a brand, they're just running one show without a brand, without TV, I don't see how they do it. I mean, when TNA was still on Spike and was still semi-popular, they had some buzz. Right now they have no buzz. Impact is just a dead promotion right now. It's really sad. But at the time, people knew, you know, TNA, and they had an audience, and they were on Spike. It was their best TV slot in their entire existence. They started on Fox Sportsnet. They bounced around to a few other places. Now they're on Pop. Nothing has ever been as good as their time on Spike. And I remember they ran MCU Park in Brooklyn for the very first time. I was at that show. That's New York, okay? This is New York that we're talking about here, one of the strongest markets in the country. And they did 5,500 people in a minor league baseball stadium that seats 7,500. Or at least at the time it did. I think now it might seat 7,000. But at the time, 7,500 was the seating capacity. Now, you could fit standing room only in there. I've been to games there where the standing room has been in excess of 9 or 10,000. But 5,500 out of 7,500, that's a great number. And of course, every year after that, they ran another 2 years or 3 years after that. After that, it was just the law of diminishing returns. Each year, the number went lower and lower until they got bounced, basically, and Ring of Honor started to run there. But they got 5,500 for a show that had Rob Van Dam and Jeff Hardy and AJ Styles and the Dudleys. I mean, there were some names on that show. So unless you have a product that's so hot, or you have some really super-duper big names on that show, I don't see how you double. Because what they're trying to do is double the number that TNA did for that show. And I just don't see it happening. Now, I saw that London is one of the cities that is supposedly being considered. Wrestling is really hot still over there in the UK. There's a, you know, a UK wrestling boom. It is very real. It is still going on. I know ICW is really popular over there. ICW did 6,000 people in the Hydro last year for their Fear and Loathing show. They did a little less than that this year. I don't know what the exact number was. It was probably like in the 5,000 range, I believe. And that's a hot brand. That's a hot brand. So I think the odds are against them, but they're out to prove people wrong. If they really are waiting to see what happens with Daniel Bryan, his contract, I mean, he's been pretty open. He's been having, you know, doing interviews about it. I believe his contract is up either late summer or early fall. I could be wrong about that, but I think that's the time period that he'll that his deal ends. And I don't know if he would have one of those 90-day non-compete clauses that everybody else had. I would imagine he would, because when he signed that deal, he was still a performer. And all performers, I think, have that 90-day non-compete provision in their contract. So they'd have to wait until the end of the year, next year, to do this. I don't know if they want to wait that long. So for Cody, the Bryan thing may be just that. It's probably just a pipe dream. You know, Brie Bella, I see Brie Bella doing interviews, and now she's saying that she thinks WWE is going to let her husband wrestle again. Now, I don't know if they're just being delusional or if they know things that we don't know yet, which is very possible, but she, you know, and she's changed her tune a little bit, and she actually thinks there's a decent chance that WWE will, you know, reverse their decision at some point soon and let him wrestle again. I think as we get closer to the end of his contract, knowing, because they gotta know. I mean, Bryan has said just unequivocally that he is leaving. If they do not let him wrestle, he will leave. And he will wrestle somewhere else, whether it's Mexico, whether it's Japan, whether it's Ring of Honor, whether it's just indie shots, at his own leisure, at the county fair. This guy's gonna wrestle again, no doubt about it. And I actually do think that they might just let him come back just to keep him from working somewhere else. I really do. Because look, if they're really concerned about his health, right? I'm sure a big part of it is they got the ongoing concussion lawsuit and they want to cover their ass and they have to stick to their guns. We can't let this guy wrestle. But circumstances change. And if he's going out there and he's getting even more opinions, third and fourth hand opinions from doctors saying, you got the green light. You're great. Your health is great. You can wrestle, you know, and they're signing off on it. Here, on the other hand, they know that he's going to leave. He's going to go wrestle somewhere else where there won't be a wellness program. There won't be doctors who can sort of watch him and make sure that everything is okay. And if they think he got a concussion, give him one of those impact concussion tests that they do. If they really are concerned about his well-being, I think there may well be a chance they'll let him wrestle and let him wrestle under their own watch, because they may feel it's actually going to be safer than him just going and wrestling somewhere else where they don't have that same kind of protocol. So you know what? I am no longer of the opinion that WWE will absolutely not let him wrestle again. I think that there is a chance that they will. And if they do, they're going to wait until we get a little closer to the end of his contract and knowing he's going to leave. All of a sudden, they're going to find Jesus and they're going to be like, you know what? We're going to let you wrestle. And it's going to be very interesting at that point to see what Bryan does, because it makes me think of that meme that we see sometimes online of the little alien dude that's saying it's a trap. I don't even know what that's from. Is that Star Wars? I don't even know. But, you know, I kind of think of that. It's like, hey, you know, could you imagine as his deal is coming to a close, all this time he's been waiting, and all of a sudden they dangle that carrot and they say, you know what? We'll let you wrestle. Or let's talk. Let's talk. Extend your deal. Sign a new deal. And we might let you wrestle. Is he stupid enough to believe them and sign a new deal, and then they'll turn around and be like, yeah, you know what? We had a change of heart. Because that would be a really shitty thing to do. I don't think they'll do that. But you know what? I put nothing past these people. Who knows? Who knows? Look, if there's money to be made and he's got all these other doctors saying it's safe, I think it's more likely we see him back in a WWE ring than we do in the ring with Cody or the Young Bucks. That's all I'm saying. This story is a real Debbie Downer here. I'm sure you've heard the news by now. It was finally confirmed by Pro Wrestling Sheet. WWE has not made any sort of announcement on this, and they won't, because they usually don't make announcements when it comes to non-wrestlers or employees of the company, as far as if people leave or if they're fired. But longtime WWE composer Jim Johnston, who gave life to a lot of the iconic themes that we all grew up on, he did songs for some of the biggest names in wrestling history. He was released by WWE this week after 32 years with the company. Kind of reminds me of timekeeper Mark Eaton. A couple years ago, he got released. Actually, it might have been a little longer than that, but a few years ago, he was released after 30 years. 30 years with the company. Cut. Gone. Didn't even see it coming. I'm just happy they haven't cut the Fink. That's gonna really upset a lot of people if that happens. Or when that happens. Hopefully not. But Johnston has not had much of a hand in a lot of the current themes. That's my understanding of it. Probably over the last 4 or 5 years or so. when they brought in CFOs as sort of their in-house band to do a lot of the music. I believe he actually did do Baron Corbin's new theme, which I happen to like. I like the newer version anyway with the lyrics. I think the lyrics really add a lot to the song. I think that was a Johnston creation. That might have been the last thing he worked on for them, was that Baron Corbin theme. You know, look, if he was making a lot of money, I would have to think he was paid very well. For all the work he did for as long as he was there for, he probably was making a pretty decent salary. And the reality is, if they're not really using him as much, and he's got a high enough salary, I can understand them wanting to cut ties, or at least go to the guy and say, look, you know, we, you know, offer a pay cut, and if he doesn't want to take it, then you know, you wish him well. I could see that, but the thing that kind of bothers me about this is that from the sounds of it, this was not a mutual decision. This was not something that either, I don't know if he expected it or not, but it's not something he wanted. This was not the desired outcome. He was fired. This was not any sort of a mutual parting of the ways here. And it sounds like he was pushed out, which is really, really shitty. And, you know, WWE, like I said, they brought in CFOs a few years ago as their new in-house band. And I like a lot of the music that CFOs has made, even though it's all a bunch of 30-second loops. Not really a lot to it. I do still like a lot of their music, but Johnston was... this guy was an institution in that company for so long. I can remember him in an interview. And he didn't do very many interviews. He was sort of like a mystery man for a very long time. You heard the name. You maybe saw what his face looked like every now and then, but you didn't really see a lot of him. He was almost in his own little cocoon there in that studio in Stamford. They kind of let him do his thing, and he was not a very sort of outgoing guy. But I can remember him doing an interview on the local UPN, what was then UPN, affiliate here in New York when SmackDown used to air on UPN in the early days. And this was it's had to be around 99 or 2000. And they promoted it during SmackDown, which they did a lot, which was smart. You know, the newscast was airing right after SmackDown, so what they would do is they would hook you by having a wrestling story, but they wouldn't air the fucking thing until like 10:45 or 10:50, like at the end of the show. And like a dumbass, I would sit there. I didn't give a shit what was going on in the news. I just wanted to see what the segment was. So yeah, good times. But he was in this segment talking about how he and Vince McMahon worked off of a handshake agreement for many years. I take it now he was under contract, otherwise how does one get released if one does not have a contract? But he and Vince, for many, many years, they just worked off of a handshake deal. Vince would give him a sense about what he was looking for in a particular character, and he would just go off and get to work. He didn't like getting feedback, he didn't actively solicit feedback from the wrestlers, because he felt that it complicated things. He liked to just watch them on TV, feel them out, and just go with it. And contrary to what you might think, he never thought that it was all that important to get to know the talent. You would think, well, you know, maybe he has a face-to-face meeting or a conference call with the wrestler and wants to learn more about their background and all this other stuff. No, it was just the opposite. He didn't want to know anything from them. Which is not to say that sometimes he didn't get that sort of feedback. But from things I've pieced together from interviews that he's done over the years, that just wasn't something that he was interested in doing. He just wanted to kind of do his own thing and felt it wasn't necessary to have that kind of feedback. He didn't feel it was necessary to know the talent. He felt it was more important to know what the talent was doing or was supposed to be doing or acting and behaving on the show, which is kind of fascinating. I mean, it makes sense. I would have thought he would want more feedback directly from the wrestlers, but apparently not. But he did an interview on the Steve Austin show back in 2014, and this is bizarre. For whatever reason, it's like the episode has been scrubbed from the internet. I can't find this thing anywhere. It was episode 85 of Austin's show, and this goes back to 2014, so this is the early days of the show. It was episode 85. It's just gone. I can't find it on any feed. I can't find it on the Podcast One site. If you search Jim Johnston, nothing comes up. Nobody even uploaded it to YouTube, or if they did, it was pulled. I can't find this thing anywhere. I don't know why. It's very bizarre. Because I wanted to go back and pull some of the stuff that he talked about from the show, and I couldn't find it. But the point is, he composed Austin's theme song, right? The iconic Stone Cold theme song. He composed that song in 8 hours. It took him just 8 hours to write and record one of the most famous theme songs ever made for a pro wrestler. Interesting note on that, now that I think about it, when Austin first interviewed Bray Wyatt on his podcast, because he's had Bray on at least a couple of times, I think. So this probably was the first time he ever had Bray Wyatt on his show. They were having a discussion about entrances and about theme music, and Bray was talking about how he came to find that Mark Crozier song, Live in Fear, which he still uses and I think is a great theme. And he tells the story about when they were in FCW, one day they said, okay, everybody's going to pick new theme music, and there's a database, and you guys are just going to go in and sit there and just pick out the song that you like. And it was a lot of rock music, and he didn't feel that rock or rap would work for his character. Imagine Bray Wyatt coming out to a rap theme. That would be kind of funny. But he knew that that just wasn't going to work for him, and he just happened to stumble on that Mark Crozier song. It wasn't even labeled, but he heard it. And anyway, it just sort of went from there. They had to track the guy down to find out who did the song. And I still think that entrance at WrestleMania 30, as aggravating as it was to see him get jobbed out to John Cena on that show, the entrance that, he and the Wyatt family made at WrestleMania 30 was badass. And they did the live version of the song. Anyway, point of all this is when they were having that conversation, Austin, shared his own story, and he told Bray that, you know, as far as the inspiration for his own song that Johnston did for him, the way it all came about is he took the song Bulls on Parade by Rage Against the Machine. He took that to Jim Johnston and said, I want you to use this as the basis for my new theme song. And from that, from Bulls on Parade, Johnston came up with the guitar riffs and the beat for what would eventually become Stone Cold's theme. And if you listen to Bulls on Parade, you definitely hear, especially at the beginning of the song, you definitely hear a little Stone Cold in the song, which, and I never knew that. So, you know, you'll find little interviews with Johnston here and there. Largely, he stayed out of the spotlight. I think WWE did a documentary, a DVD documentary on him a few years ago, but this is a guy who just does not get the recognition that he fully deserves. I don't think I can sit here and overstate how important wrestler entrances and their theme songs are in helping these guys get over with the audience. And the sheer number that he was responsible for is staggering. I mean, Austin, Rock, Triple H, Undertaker, DX. Chris Warren was a friend of his that he brought in to help compose the DX theme song. Ultimate Warrior, just so many others. I don't think he did Real American. I was going to say Hogan's theme, which actually was not originally supposed to be Hogan's theme. But I don't think he did Real American. I know Rick Derringer did the vocals. I think Derringer produced it. But I think that predated Johnston's tenure. Actually, it did predate it, because the earliest work I think that Johnston did for WWE was in 86. And Real American came out the year before that. So I guess he had nothing to do with that. But they've been pushing out a lot of his old unreleased music lately as part of these. Have you seen these uncaged album releases? I don't know how many of you have been keeping up with that, but they've had four of them now that they've released on iTunes and Spotify. Uncaged 4, which is probably going to be the final one, that came out just last week. I would be surprised if a lot of you are aware of this, because they did absolutely no promotion for it. It was as though they were just pushing it out because people were nagging them about it. I've read, and this is not confirmed, but I've read that there's a lot of theme music sort of aficionados out there who follow this sort of thing, who said that not only was it not a happy split, but the people that work for and run the WWE music group, that they were no fans of Johnston. And what they're trying to do now is they want to replace all of his trademark music, which they started doing recently with Kane. You know, if you listen to Kane's theme, they've tweaked that theme to make it a little bit different. And in very short order, and again, this is not confirmed, but in very short order, we may be hearing a lot of other Jim Johnston themes either being changed altogether or being tweaked in some way. Hopefully No Chance in Hell is safe for Vince McMahon, because I would hate for them to change that song. That would be sacrilege if they changed it. Think about it. Vince McMahon has been using that song now for almost 20 years, I guess, right? Yeah, 99. And I think that would be a Johnston theme. So I hope that's not true. I hope they're not going to, you know, go back and just start changing themes for, you know, when these guys come out. I think that would be ridiculous. It sounds like these new music folks had it out for the guy. I don't know why. Maybe Johnston was, you know, difficult to work with. I mean, I don't know Johnston personally. I'm just giving him credit for all the work he's done. It's very possible that maybe there's a good reason for them to not have wanted to work with him. I don't know. But it definitely does not sound like an amicable parting of the ways. And I think the guy deserves better than that. I think he should be a no-doubter for a Hall of Fame induction, but they don't really honor behind-the-scenes people like that, like production people. You know, if Ultimate Warrior had, the one really good idea this guy had, if he had gotten his wish with what he wanted that Warrior Award to be, given how influential these theme songs have been to the talent over the years, I would say this guy should be a lock for a Warrior Award induction, had the Warrior Award been what it was supposed to be. But, he doesn't have a debilitating illness, nor can they use a Warrior Award induction for Jim Johnston to get any sort of mainstream publicity, so of course they're not going to do it. But his contributions, I think, speak for themselves, and hopefully one day he'll be able to be honored, because I think it's something that he's very, very deserving of. By the way, Will Ospreay had a revelation on Twitter yesterday. I don't know if this is not sad tweet, but I didn't know where else to put this, so I'll just mention it here. But he posted this. He said, wait, a championship title is made with a leather strap, right? Just had a thought. Isn't that made from cows? Okay, how long before we get vegan championship titles? First of all, nowhere in that tweet does he use the word belt, which worries me, because it means Vince McMahon's master plan to brainwash all of us seems to be working. But I want everybody to tweet Will Ospreay and let him know that it was Daniel Bryan, right here on this show, right here on the Sound Off, who first pitched the idea of a hemp belt. He never did get the chance to do it, because that was the same weekend Sheamus kicked him in the face at WrestleMania and pinned him in 18 seconds. But it's in my intro every single week when he says, your title belt is made of leather, you're not a real vegan. And then he goes on to say that, you know, if I win and I'm still the champion, we're going to have a hemp belt. And poor Will just has no idea. So be sure to tweet him and let him know, at Will Ospreay. Daniel Bryan was the first to pitch the idea, and we can blame Sheamus for it not happening. Raw from last Monday was live from Knoxville, Tennessee. 2,000 votes in the Twitter poll, 31% thumbs up, 69% thumbs down. This was not a great show at all, and that's being kind. There was a note, by the way, that I saw on PW Insider, that there are over 400 tickets, and this was earlier in the week, so it could very well be more than that by now, but there were over 400 tickets on StubHub for the 25th anniversary Raw show at the Manhattan Center coming up in January. That's almost half the total capacity of the entire venue. That grand ballroom does not fit more than probably 1,000 or 1,100 people max, I'm guessing. So basically, half the tickets that were sold out instantly when tickets first went on sale went to scalpers and people who are now selling them for double, triple, quadruple what they paid for them. They have some seats on there for $1,500 a pop if you want to pay $1,500 to go see Raw, if you have some kind of mental condition, perhaps. I don't know who would pay $1,500 to see Raw, regardless of what building it's in. You have to be out of your mind. But that sucks. That sucks. I know this happens all the time. This is not new. I just wish there was a better system in place for these things. You know, I don't know how you stop it, but I'm sure I'm not the only person who would have liked to have gone to the show who looks at that and just says, the hell with it. It's not worth it. You know, I mean, but look, I guess if the demand is there and they can sell them at those prices, then hey, more power to them, I guess. But I'm sure the week of the show, there'll be lots of tickets they don't sell that all of a sudden drop like a rock in price. So if you are interested still in going to that show and you were locked out like I was, that would be my suggestion. Just wait, honestly, until that weekend or even the day of, and then go on a site like StubHub, and I guarantee you a lot of those tickets are going to come down. I don't know how much they'll come down in price, but you may have to just wait until the last minute. Anyway, the show this week, Bray Wyatt. I'm actually going to start with him for a change. He got a win on TV this week. You heard that right. It was against Matt Hardy, who's been losing to everybody late. I think I beat Matt Hardy a few weeks ago. So that makes it a little less impressive, but a win is a win. But it served another purpose. It finally, at long last, looks like after all these months, the loss to Bray may have finally broken Matt Hardy. Or maybe the better word for it is he's awakened Matt Hardy. Sports Illustrated had the report first that the plan is to create a new character for Matt, very similar, if not identical, to the Broken character from TNA, but not using the Broken name. Probably Woken, which is what Matt's now going by in his Twitter account, Woken Matt Hardy. The funny part about that, if that's true, if they really are going to go with Woken or something similar but not quite Broken, what's hilarious to me is that in the same story, it includes this quote from Ed Nordholm of Anthem, which I'm going to talk, because this is a whole other big story I'll talk about in a second, but this was the quote from Owl Ed. He said, "We've seen the character development," he's talking about Matt Hardy now, "and we'll be interested to see where they take that concept. Our new talent agreements all incorporate language that allow talent to continue to use their impact persona after they leave the company. We are working with our legal team to amend our existing agreements to extend this to all of our current and former talent." That would put the Broken Universe back in the hands of the Hardys. And yet, what's hilarious about this is that it looks like WWE is not even planning on using the Broken name anyway. They're just going to go do their own thing. Now, the character is probably going to be identical, but if they don't call the guy Broken Matt or use a lot of the same terms, it just begs the question, why the hell did they wait so long to do this in the first place? Right? It's like all of a sudden there's this big legal change and Impact is going to let everybody use their characters, including the Hardys. And now WWE, after how many months? Right? How many months have these guys been back now? 8 months? 9 months? Something like that? All of a sudden they're finally going to pull the trigger. The guy is just, he's deader than standing water in a sink. Now they decide it's time, finally, to do the Broken stuff. But we're not going to call him Broken. We'll call him Woken. Well, why didn't you call him Woken 6 months ago? I mean, maybe there's some legal reason for it. I don't see it, but I just think that's funny. Now of all times is when they do this. But that was a pretty big story this week. PW Insider said that Anthem is doing a total 180 on their policy, not just with the Hardys, but going forward with all contracted talent. They will be given and will retain complete ownership of their characters and of their likenesses. So not only would the Hardys be able to use the Broken Universe, if somebody, let's say, left Impact tomorrow and wanted to go to WWE and use their Impact name, they can do so. Although that doesn't mean WWE will want them to. Knowing how they like to put their mark on things, we may one day have, EC4 making his debut on Raw. Or maybe EC3 wouldn't want to give up the rights to his name to WWE. And he would want to go by something else so that he can keep ownership of EC3 for himself in case he ever leaves. He can use it elsewhere. So I'm just using him as an example. I'm not saying EC3 is going anywhere, although he should. But I think it's a great move for the talent. It's fantastic for them. I think Nordholm deserves credit for doing it. I'd love to know the reason why he's doing this. My guess is either A, they realized they were going to lose to the Hardys in court. You know, the Hardys, they've been very adamant that those contracts that they signed were in their favor, and that a court case would end with a win for them. They were convinced of this. So either that or B, they've got real money problems, and they just decided, you know what, it's not worth it to keep pursuing this. And we know they're having money issues as far as how much money they're willing to put into this thing, so maybe it's a little bit of both. Believe me, they didn't just wake up one morning and decide to do this out of the goodness of their hearts. There's got to be a reason for it. Call me cynical, but there's got to be a reason for it. It's a great PR move, but probably one that comes too little too late. They really did not endear themselves very well coming out of that whole debacle with the Hardys. And you could say that, hey, maybe Impact was in the right legally. We'll never know now. But, you know, PR-wise, they didn't look good at all. I mean, they looked like the evil villain, you know, coming out of that whole situation. So I don't know how much goodwill this curries with the fans, but it should with the talent, and maybe it makes Impact a more desirable destination for some of that talent in the future. So I think for that reason, it's a great move. Now, Matt's already got videos up on his YouTube channel teasing this new Woken character. He's teasing the return of Vanguard 1 and Senor Benjamin. Looks like this is really happening. This is not a false alarm. We've had so many false alarms with this guy over the last several months where it looks like, oh, they're going to do it. They're going to do the Broken stuff, and then nothing ever happens. So it looks like this is really happening, and I only hope And I said this before he even came back to WWE when the rumors started that, hey, the Hardys might come back, but we weren't sure. I said this back then, and I'll say it again now. I wanted to see Broken Matt in WWE, but only if they gave this guy some degree of creative control. You're never going to get 100% creative control unless your name is Hogan. You're just not going to get it. But give this guy some level of creative control over that character, some leeway, because... And it looks like he has, at least on social media. I mean, Matt can go on social media and do whatever he wants. So I just don't want to be in a situation here where they're finally going to do this character on TV every week, but the stuff that Matt does on his YouTube channel is actually more entertaining than what they do on TV, which could very well happen. And, you know, all of a sudden it makes the writers look bad and maybe they take it out on Matt. I mean, look, I don't know, but... we'll see. I'm very anxious to see what they do with this. My fear has always been that, you know, if WWE gets its claws into this thing, what's it going to look like? You know, I mean, you either love the broken stuff or you hate it. I know there's a lot of you listening to this right now that can't stand it. You're not looking forward to this. You think it's too hokey and stupid. Jim Cornette probably hates the hell out of it, you know, that sort of thing. But I was always very entertained by it. It got me to watch Impact, sometimes anyway, when I would not have otherwise watched Impact. What were some of those shows they did? Final Destination. I don't even remember now what they called it, but some of those shows they did from the Hardy Compound were really fun. And I would love to see something similar in WWE, but I am a little fearful. I'm a little fearful of what they may do to this thing. What does Broken Matt or Woken Matt, what does he look like on WWE television, with WWE writers or Vince McMahon having input into the direction of that character? What does that character look like? That's what worries me. I've got my fingers crossed. I say just let the man have his fun. Matt is a very creative guy. You listen to anybody who knows Matt, who worked with Matt, going back to the Omega days when they had their own little promotion, they will tell you that Matt Hardy is a very, very creative guy. I say let him do his thing. There is no need to put your own stamp on it. Let him have his fun. Seth Rollins pins Cesaro, best match on the show. After the match, Rollins said next week, that being tomorrow night, on Raw, he and Dean Ambrose are cashing in on their tag team title rematch, and they're going to challenge Sheamus and Cesaro for the Raw tag team titles. Ambrose missed the show this past week. He was on his honeymoon with Renee Young. So cue the new wave of creepy tweets and Instagram posts from all the obsessed female Ambrose fans. It's horrifying. It absolutely is horrifying. Some of the posts that these people are subjected to when it comes to, like, if you're dating one of the wrestlers, or even worse, if you're marrying them, if you're engaged to them. I mean, we're talking like boiled bunny level bullshit. Like Alicia Silverstone in The Crush with some of these posts that I sometimes see. It's kind of scary. And hopefully Renee isn't getting too much of that. Roman Reigns pinned Elias here this week. Week one of the Open Challenge for the Intercontinental title. I thought the match was kind of boring, I'll be honest with you. I didn't really like it. I mean, good for the Drifter. I'm happy to see him being featured on the show. I get a kick out of his act now. I never thought I would say that. You guys remember the Drifter from NXT and what I thought about him there. But I actually enjoy his act now. Less so when the bell rings. I haven't really seen an exciting Drifter match, but I've seen much better Roman Reigns matches, put it that way. This was nothing special. Bo Dallas and Curtis Axel were out there with Elias. I don't know if that'll be a permanent thing until Miz comes back, or if it was just for the 1 week. After the match, Samoa Joe attacked Roman from behind on the ramp, put him in the choke. He choked him out. And that sets up either a program between the two, or maybe he just sets up Joe as victim number two in the Open Challenge. I would have to think they're going to do more than one match. Although I don't see Joe winning the championship. There's no Raw pay-per-view until February, so it's not setting up a pay-per-view match. But I could get behind Joe and Reigns. I mean, I was just saying last week, I would have had Finn Balor win the title from Miz and have Joe choke him out and start something between the two of them for the Intercontinental title. But, you know, Joe against Roman is cool too. I bet Balor wishes they had gone with my idea from last week after what they did with him on this show. We'll get to that. It was supposed to be Sasha Banks, Bayley, and Mickie James against Paige's new trio, Paige, Mandy Rose, and Sonya Deville, which is now going by the name Absolution. Okay. Sasha came out. Her partners never did. Instead, they showed them laid out backstage, which left Sasha all by her lonesome out there with Paige and her pals. And they took turns talking, and Mandy Rose praised Paige, and Sonya Deville praised Paige. They both put her over, and they said they have pledged their allegiance to Paige. They wanted Sasha to do the same. Instead, Sasha attacked them, which was a mistake because they beat her down 3-on-1. And Paige laid her out last with the Rampage. Paige against Sasha Banks is now official for Raw tomorrow night. This will be Paige's first singles match since her comeback, and I believe the first singles match between her and Sasha in over 2 years. Last time they wrestled was during that period where they had we had Team Bad and Team, what was the other one? Team PCP, I think, or PCB, or QVC, or whatever the fuck. Yeah, that dark little period would have been the last time that these two had a singles match. Asuka beat Dana Brooke in 4 seconds with an armbar. Doesn't get any more dominant than that. This was perfect. This was the perfect length of a Dana Brooke match. Absolution came back out, surrounded the ring with Asuka inside. This went on forever. They just stood there. Asuka's in the ring. She's got a smile on her face. She's surrounded. What's going to happen? We have a standoff. I'll tell you what happened. Nothing. Nothing happened. She left. Paige waved at her, and Asuka left. And that was that. And remember my plan last week for a Women's Royal Rumble match if they do one this year? Which is not a guarantee, by the way. It's just an idea. But if they do one, I laid out how I would do it, who would be in it, where it would lead to at WrestleMania. If you remember, the final destination that I pitched would have been, well, you know, Paige beating Alexa at the Rumble to become the champion, and then Asuka wins the Rumble match, and you do Asuka and Paige at WrestleMania for the title. And it looks like that could be where we're headed. We've got a Fatal Four-Way fever with the Cruiserweights. How fitting, after my rant last week on all the Fatal Four-Ways and the Fatal Five-Ways with the women. Not to be left out, the Cruiserweights are now getting in on the fun. Kurt Angle said that in order to determine a new number one contender to Enzo's Cruiserweight title, there would be not one. Oh no. There would be two Fatal Four-Way matches. One on this show, which Rich Swann won. He beat Tozawa, Daivari, and Noam Dar. And there will be another Fatal Four-Way tomorrow night. I don't think they've announced the participants yet, but I, you know, given the angle they've been doing, probably looking at Cedric Alexander, Drew Gulak, Tony Nese, and Mustafa Ali would be my guess. And the winner of that match will then meet Rich Swann the following week, and the winner of that match will be the new number one contender. Sounds very convoluted to me, but look, they've got time to kill. We're in, like, the dead zone now, people. This is... I mean, you talk about lame duck, especially on this show. At least SmackDown has Clash of Champions in a few weeks. Raw's got nothing until the Royal Rumble. So we are in this end-of-the-year period before the new year where there's just a whole lot of nothing going on. There's a whole lot of nothing going on. And you got to stretch and you got to kill time. And so you end up with multiple Fatal 4-Way matches. Now, WWE put out a survey this week asking people, why are you not watching 205 Live? Which I laughed when I saw that question. Like, why are you not watching 205 Live? And this was, now it gave you a series of answers. I assume, I didn't actually take the survey. I saw the survey, but I don't know why I didn't get it. I usually get links to these. But I assume you could pick more than one answer, as I will do here as I run through this question. Why have you not watched or not regularly watched 205 Live? Please, here we go. Please select all that apply. And these were the answers that you could choose. WWE 205 Live slips my mind or I forget to watch. True. Cruiserweight superstars on the show are not that interesting. I wouldn't put that on the talent. I mean, I'm not interested in everybody they have on that show, but I wouldn't say that. Watching Cruiserweight matches on other WWE shows is enough for me. True. There's absolutely nothing all that different from what I've seen. And I admit I am not one of those people, excuse me, watching 205 Live every single week. I admit right here and now, I am not watching the show every single week. But I have watched it. And from what I have seen, there is nothing all that different on that show The matches may have a little bit more length to them, but it's not like they're so much more exciting. And I will hear from you guys every now and then, oh man, there was this, you gotta check this great match out from 205 Live this week. But there really isn't anything all that different that separates what you're seeing on Tuesday nights from what you're seeing on Monday nights. So, you know, for me, there's no real incentive to watch. So yeah, I would say watching the cruiserweight matches on the other shows is enough for me. Matches are repetitive. Yes. In fact, that's not a cruiserweight problem. That is a WWE problem. The whole product is repetitive. Every show. Raw is repetitive. SmackDown is repetitive. I'm repetitive talking about this every single week. So yes, I would say the matches are repetitive. Yes. Not interested in a WWE cruiserweight division. Sadly, the answer is yes. This is not what I was expecting coming out of that cruiserweight classic. It's like night and day. They had something really special with that tournament. And you knew it was going to be hard to kind of bottle that up and keep that fresh every single week. But even from week one, we never got what we saw in that Cruiserweight Classic. It's like that was something completely different than what they ended up giving us. So, yeah, the way they do it, I'm not interested in a Cruiserweight division. Planning to watch 205 Live, but just have not had the time. Well, that's true. Time is an issue, too. There's just so much programming. There's only so much time that people have, right? I know a lot of you guys. You work. You have families. Or Xboxes. Right? It's only so much time in a day. Plus, you got SmackDown that night. I mean, how much can you tolerate? I prefer watching other weekly WWE shows instead. I wouldn't say that either. I watch enough WWE shows and do not have time for 205 Live. Yes. Yes. Check mark. Yes. The announce team is not that interesting. Who is the announce team now? It was a Vic Joseph, that Vic Joseph guy who I think did the announcing for House of Hardcore, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's what, him and Nigel McGuinness? I mean, when I heard them, the times I've heard them, they sound fine. I would not put that... Actually, that's really stupid to put in here. This is an answer to the question of why are you not watching 205 Live because the announce team is not that interesting? You could put Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler on this show, and I still wouldn't watch. The announce team has nothing to do with this. Prefer to watch other non-WWE shows. No, not really. I'm not a big TV watcher, to be honest with you. Lately, I'm more of a Netflix guy myself. I'm about to wrap up season 3 of Narcos. 205 Live storylines are not engaging. True. Busy when the show initially airs and forget to watch at a later time. No, I know exactly when it airs. I'm not using that as an excuse. And last but not least, cruiserweight superstars do not have a significant role in WWE pay-per-view events or Monday Night Raw. True. They have their own little bubble that they're sort of stuck in, and they don't come across as having any sort of significant role on the show. And there are plenty of times on Raw where I'll use that as a bathroom break. It's just how it is. So, that's the survey question that they put out this week. Now, there was another question, and to me, this just tells me that they just don't get it. They just don't get it. Question is, if WWE superstars from Raw or SmackDown were to engage more frequently with cruiserweight superstars on 205 Live, how would this impact your viewing of the show? You would be more likely to watch, somewhat more likely, no impact, or even less likely to watch the show. Note, by the way, the word engage. Engage more frequently with the cruiserweight stars. That can mean anything. That can mean talking. That can mean wrestling. That can mean they bump into each other backstage. I don't know what that means. But they don't get it. They don't get it. So they just figure, well, if we take some mid-card level guys from SmackDown, who maybe aren't doing much of anything, maybe Chad Gable and Shelton Benjamin show up 1 week on 205 Live. You know what? Chad Gable and Shelton Benjamin showing up and having a match against two cruiserweight guys could be a hell of a match. It could be. It could be. But to me, the answer to this question is not, well, why are people not watching 205 Live? Because we wouldn't be doing this survey if people were watching. So clearly people are not watching this show. So how can we fix this? Oh, I know. I know. We'll just take name guys from Raw and SmackDown and we'll put them on the show. They'll engage with the cruiserweight talent. That'll get people watching. No, because the cruiserweight division is not working. There's a lot of really talented guys in the cruiserweight division. But if you have to put a survey out asking, why are you not watching, then it's not working. And it's not working because you don't have Raw and SmackDown guys on there. We get enough of them on Raw and SmackDown every week. Adding a few names here and there to 205 Live, you know what? It would be very similar to what they did, I guess, in NXT. For a while, there was a period of time where main roster talents were cycled down to NXT. Tyson Kidd, he had a rebirth. Him and Natalya down there turned into a great heel act. Tyson Kidd was awesome in NXT, and it was great for him. Not so much when they would bring in somebody like a Titus O'Neil, who didn't do shit. So, again, if they want to do that, then by all means, go ahead. You probably will end up with having some better matches. But it ain't going to get me and a lot of other people to start watching the show. Because what people enjoyed about the Cruiserweight Classic, which obviously did well enough for them to go ahead and launch a whole division. I mean, I'm sure if nobody watched the Cruiserweight Classic, they wouldn't be having a Cruiserweight division. It did well enough where they said, hey, we're going to make this a part of the show every single week. Cool, right? But then it was the polar opposite of what they gave people in the Cruiserweight Classic. The storytelling, letting them go out and do things that very obviously they're holding back on. I mean, I see some of these Cruiserweight matches, and I understand wanting to limit the danger and all that, but it's very obvious that these guys are working at a slower speed than they normally would. That's not what people want. Has nothing to do if Mojo Rawley makes a guest appearance on 205 Live. Who cares? Who cares? Yeah, the guy who just honked his horn outside, he don't give a fuck. He agrees with me. So I think they're thinking about this all wrong. At least they're asking for feedback. I mean, I can appreciate that, but I think they're asking for the wrong feedback. That's all I'm saying. The stuff at the end of the show, Kane against Jason Jordan, this was just horrendous stuff. I mean, they had like a 2-minute match. Kane's out there getting chants of Let's Go Mayor because they were in Knoxville, which isn't far from, I guess, Knox County, where he's running for office in the election next year. So, you know, he's just assaulting Jordan. He throws Jordan out of the ring. Jordan's selling it like he hurt his knee again, which at first I thought, you know, he was faking it because he's very subtly, you know, doing this heel turn here. And I thought, well, he's just trying to weasel out of this match here by feigning an injury and getting counted out. But then Kane, you know, he got back in the ring. Kane threw him out again. And now it's like, oh, okay, I guess he's not faking the injury and storyline. I guess Kane really is just killing this guy and we're supposed to have sympathy for him, which makes it even more weird because he's been acting like such a spoiled brat now for the last few weeks. So this is all going on, and Kane is destroying this guy and attacking his leg, and all of a sudden, Finn Balor's music hits, and out comes Finn Balor. Not the demon, just plain old Finn. And I'm thinking, well, he's finally going to get his revenge. I said last week, I guess he's not getting his revenge, right? Well, there he is on Raw. He comes out. I'm like, finally, this guy's going to get some retribution on Kane for those two attacks that went, unopposed. He didn't do anything, right? He got chokeslammed 3 times and pinned. Then he got tombstoned on the stage. And they just had no interaction after that. And Balor didn't seem overly concerned about finding Kane and chasing him and getting his revenge. So as he's coming to the ring, they cut to commercial. How exciting. They come back from commercial. We now have an impromptu match between Finn Balor and Kane. And there was absolutely nothing different about this match. There was absolutely nothing special about this match. They were just having a back and forth match. Didn't even go 3 minutes before Kane took a chair, got himself DQ'd, and laid waste to Finn Balor. Over and over, this went on for, hitting him in the back. He laid him out with the steel chair until Braun Strowman's music hits. The same Braun Strowman, they did an injury angle with him last week where Kane crushed his throat. Wasn't even gone 1 week. Out comes Strowman, showing no signs, by the way, of any kind of injury. Nothing on his neck or throat or anything. Like, it's just like it never happened. So out he comes. Balor vanishes. Balor became that guy who, when the more important guy comes out to interfere, the other person in the ring disappears, and you don't know where he go. He just, poof, vanishes. So Balor was never seen again. Hell of a follow-up with him. And the show ends with this back-and-forth brawl where Strowman ends up getting the better of Kane, and he gives him a power slam under the ring steps, which honestly looked kind of weak, although he was trying to protect the guy. I mean, Kane is almost 50 years old. But this went on forever. This just wouldn't end. And the crowd wasn't reacting to it hardly at all. They really weren't. Not for like a big show-closing angle like this. I mean, Strowman, when his music hit and he came out, he got a big reaction. But that these guys were out there for so long doing a whole lot of nothing. He did the same thing to Kane. He went after his throat, took a chair to his throat a couple of times. And the show ended, I swear to God, the show ended with Kane wheezing. Like he was having an asthma attack and clutching his throat. And just sort of, he was flopping around. He went over the barricade. He left through the crowd holding his throat. Nothing happened. That was it. He just left through the crowd and the show ended. So Finn Balor, destroyed yet again by Kane, left as an afterthought at the end of the show. He's still on Twitter, having fun with all of this, all the rumors and everything about him no longer wrestling Brock at the Royal Rumble. I don't see how you can do that match, even if this is fake news, and Finn Balor is going to challenge Brock Lesnar for the championship at the Royal Rumble. I'm not even sure I want to see it at this point. I mean, why in the world would we want to see Finn Balor challenging Brock Lesnar now for the championship after the way that he's been, you know, handled on the show now for the last several weeks? Any interest I had in that match just plummeted. Why would I want to see that match? The guy can't stand up to Kane. What makes me think he's going to stand up to Brock Lesnar? They've gone out of their way to try to make you certainly not look at him as a viable challenger for the championship. So if that was their goal, then hey, mission accomplished. I'll give you a little seal clap here. Well done. Well done. But he's online posting memes, having fun with it. Okay, fine. Let him have fun. I hope he's enjoying himself. I really do. I hope he's having a blast. And, you know, good for him. Good for him. But what they've done with him is they've taken somebody who the fans still like. It's not like they've turned on him or anything. The fans still like Balor. I mean, he gets a nice reaction when he comes out and does the thing with his hands and all that. But they've taken a guy who I think could have been something special on the show, and they have let you know, they have beaten you over the head with this, that this guy is nothing special. We're pushing Braun, doing stuff with Kane, because these are our two big monsters. Roman is the chosen one, we all know that. He's got the IC title. Can't put that on Balor, gotta put it on Roman. And meanwhile, Balor is doing a whole lot of nothing. On the same show, by the way, where the Good Brothers are also doing nothing. I'm not sure what good would even be accomplished at this point by putting the three of them together, but can't hurt. They won't even do that. So Balor just sort of floats aimlessly week to week. Great. Wonderful. SmackDown. Let's get the hell off of Raw, because Raw sucked last week. Let's talk about SmackDown, which really wasn't all that much better. Although the voting, it was better in the voting. 62% thumbs up, 38% thumbs down out of 1,500 of you who voted. How does this show get a thumbs up with no Rusev? You know what Tuesday was? Tuesday was Rusev Day. How do you have SmackDown without Rusev? It was nowhere to be found on this show. Shane McMahon was not happy with Daniel Bryan not firing Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn the week before after he left the building. Can I just say something here? I guess I can. Since it's my show, I can say whatever the hell I want. Bryan, in this segment, this opening set, I'm not going to recap everything that was said, but basically he was giving his reasons why he did not fire Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. And one of the reasons he mentioned was, they'll just go to Raw. So, if you're the general manager of a show, which he is, makes perfect sense. Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn, they're talented. They're two big stars, or at least Owens is. And so you don't want them to just walk onto the other show. That actually does make sense. But Shane made a damn good case for firing them. He pointed out that, first of all, Kevin Owens assaulted his father, who happens to be the chairman of the company. Sami Zayn interfered in his Hell in a Cell match and cost him the match against Kevin Owens. And then at Survivor Series, the two of them turned their back on the blue team and tried to cost them the match. So when you lay it all out like that, he makes a pretty compelling case for terminating these two guys. I'm just saying. I think I side with Shane on this issue. New Day beat Chad Gable and Shelton Benjamin, which was surprising. Don't know why they did that, but I guess it sets up what else? It sets up a three-way, which we're going to get now at Clash of Champions. It's going to be the Usos defending the tag team titles against the New Day and Gable and Benjamin, which actually should be a hell of a match. The Bludgeon Brothers were dominant again. I hope everything's okay with Luke Harper. I saw that they had a show, I think, in Peru last night, and I think he left early. So I saw Mojo Rawley teamed with Eric Rowan. Oh my God, what a team. What a team. Mojo Rawley and Eric Rowan. So I don't know why Harper went home, if there was a family emergency, if there's something else going on. I hope everything's okay. But on this show, the Bludgeon Brothers, dominant yet again, beat the Hype Bros. They pinned Zack Ryder. After the match, when Dasha Bot tried to interview Ryder in the ring, Mojo Rawley attacked him from behind, thus ending the Hype Bros. It was the heel turn 6 months in the making. At least it feels like it's been building for that long. So where does each guy go from here? Where do they go from here? I got one email from somebody. Where do you see these two going now that they've broken up? You know where I see them going? Nowhere. Where are they going to go? I assume they'll have a match or a feud. I don't know how long this could go on for. At least one match. I assume Mojo goes over. No reason for him not to. And gets the big push. And by big push, I mean he'll be the one losing mid-card matches on TV. And Zack Ryder? I don't know what happens now with Zack Ryder. Probably the same that always happens. He's a good hand to have to lose to whoever they need him to lose to. But I don't see them doing much with either one of these guys. Mojo, at least, I think he'll get TV time once this feud is over. But on a show where Jinder Mahal had a six-month run with the WWE title, you know what? Anything's possible. We could be seeing WWE champion Mojo Rawley 6 months from now. I put nothing past these people. But I really don't see either one of these guys doing anything of any significance in the near term. I just don't see a spot for them. AJ Styles beat both Singh brothers in a handicap match after giving Samir, I think it was, a Styles clash off the ropes down onto Sunil. After the match, Jinder Mahal laid both Singh brothers out with the Colossus, and these two guys made that move look like the most devastating thing that you've ever seen. They overbumped for the Colossus. And I forgot which one of the brothers it was, the last one that Jinder gave them. The guy literally, he just rotated in midair. Didn't even land on his back. He like landed on his shoulder and his knees, but it looked impressive as all hell. That alone should have earned them a spot still on the SmackDown roster, but sadly for them, it sounds like their run on SmackDown may be over. That's the rumor. There's talk of maybe them being moved down possibly to the NXT brand, at least until they figure out what to do with them next. I think they've done a great job in the role. You know, hopefully they find a place for them. I think as lackeys for Jinder. I'll tell you what, you know, Jinder's not going anywhere. I don't think he's going to be WWE champion again. But Jinder's going to be on that show. Jinder without the Singh brothers sounds horrible to me. I mean, Jinder with the Singh brothers ain't much better. But Jinder without them? I don't really know where the logic is in that. I feel like he works better as a character, as having somebody with him, lackeys with him. So I don't really get that. If they're going to split them up, I don't understand it. Wouldn't be the first time that WWE has split an act up and just made me scratch my head. See Rusev and Lana as an example. Although, had they not done that, we wouldn't have ended up with Rusev and Aiden English, which I'm very much enjoying that pairing, even though they weren't on the show. We now know that Paige, Mandy Rose, and Sonya Deville on Raw are collectively known as Absolution. And here on SmackDown, Ruby Riott, Liv Morgan, and Sarah Logan have a name for their own crew. The Riott Squad, which sounds a lot better than Absolution. That's Riott with two T's, because they've added a T to the end of Ruby Riott's name. As such, going forward, Booker T will now simply be known as Booker. You gotta get that T from somewhere. Cutting costs. So the Riott Squad beat Charlotte, Naomi, and Natalya, who bailed on her team in the first minute of the match. Then they took out Naomi, by ramming her very hard into the steel steps outside. They're doing an injury angle now with her. There's an update on WWE.com. She's got probably contusions, because let's be honest, every time there's an injury angle, you end up with contusions here in WWE. But she's all messed up now after this injury angle. They even strapped her to a gurney and they wheeled her out while the match was still in progress, leaving Charlotte all by herself. Sound familiar? Didn't we just see this on Monday with Sasha being left all alone? So Ruby pinned Charlotte with the riot kick. We got a Saw parody for the latest Fashion File segment. Let it be known that I did a Saw parody before they did. Back on episode 310, I believe it was. My little Saw parody with Dixie Carter. They were trapped in a room. Breezango was trapped in a room with the Ascension. They were all chained to the wall. And Breeze and Fandango escaped just in time to avoid the release of a poison gas. Unfortunately, they left the Ascension behind. But they're okay. It's hard to kill something when it's already dead. Main event was a no disqualification match to determine the new number one Twitter champion between Randy Orton and Kevin Owens. Orton absolutely destroyed this guy with a kendo stick at the beginning of the match. I don't know, the beef here may be real, because he took that kendo stick and he waylaid Kevin Owens to the point where they had to bleep out. Owens was cursing. They had to bleep out the language. He didn't look like he was having a very fun time in there with Orton here at the beginning of this match. I guess the story here, there's no real heat. I mean, the story here is that Orton is obviously very upset at Kevin Owens, not just for all the Twitter insults, but for trying to cost Team SmackDown the match at Survivor Series. I guess Orton took that personally, and so he took his frustrations out on Kevin Owens here at the beginning of the match. He had to make it look stiff, and they did. End of the match, Orton chases Owens up onto the stage. Remember now, it's no DQ. And with his back turned, Randy Orton is attacked from behind by Sami Zayn with a chair, who hits him in the leg. Now, Daniel Bryan had banned Sami Zayn from ringside for this match, but as Corey Graves pointed out, technically they were not ringside. They were in the aisleway, which is true. Owens tossed Orton back into the ring. Orton managed to hit a draping DDT and went for the RKO. Owens avoided it, hit a chop block, and then hit a frog splash for the win. The pin on Randy Orton. Kevin Owens retains his title as undisputed Twitter champion. And look, there were some good things on this show, but this was far from the most exciting episode of SmackDown. Not a great week overall, I don't think, for WWE on TV. Dolph Ziggler. He was not on the show this week, but he was on Edge and Christian's podcast, and he spoke very candidly about his position in the company right now and why he is not all that happy. Here's what he said. I'm going to read this and then I'll give my thoughts. He said, "I'm not a giant guy, so maybe in some other world I would have worked here for a year and a half as a caddy and a cheerleader and then went away. So I see the positive. Like, hey, I've been here 12 years, almost always regularly on TV. But I think at a point that becomes a burden of not going away, of always getting passed over. You get passed over a handful of times for a couple of years, and then you start to have more of a cult following and it gets hot. But after a couple of years of not having the trigger pulled and the 8-year-old kids now know that you're in that role, I've noticed in the last 2 years that now even my live event matches are a little hard for me to do my job because I come out and a 10-year-old kid goes, 'I know you're losing.' It's one thing to have 40-year-old guys going, 'I know what's going to happen. That's fine, I'm here to put on a show and we'll have fun,' but when you get in that role and you miss years of not going with it, it becomes a burden. Now my job of making somebody that should be ready for the world title picture becomes harder. If you see that the last 6 months or year of TV, basically I'm a gatekeeper to the guy from NXT coming up who they have high expectations for, but if I lose for 8 consecutive months before they show up, they're no longer getting that pat on the back from me to get up a notch. So I feel like it's almost taking back from my role. So I don't know what the change would be to switch things up or to just disappear here and there. I've said this to the boss on several occasions. I've said to him, 'I've made a career out of almost never winning, which is awesome, but at some point I have to be seen as somebody who could win. Wins and losses don't matter unless you're the guy who loses every single night. And if you are that guy, then maybe you should be in the dark match and not be fighting somebody to see who goes for the world title. And even if you do pull that rabbit out of the hat, people know it's not going to be a long-term thing. Sage words from Dolph Ziggler. He's 100%, 100% dead on. Dolph Ziggler, to me, may be the greatest victim in WWE history of the start and stop push. They have teased big things with this guy so many times over the years that it's the classic case of the boy who cried Dolph. That's really what it is. And I've said this on the show before. That Survivor Series show in 2014, when Dolph was the sole survivor for his team, and he got the assist from Sting. Sting made his debut in that match. He walked out. He debuted that very night. That was a big deal. And he gave the assist to Dolph. He pulled Dolph on top of Rollins, and Ziggler was the sole survivor. That night was the beginning of the end for Dolph Ziggler. And it didn't have to be. It could have been the beginning of something big for Dolph Ziggler, but looking back, it turned out to be the beginning of the end. Roman Reigns was out with after the hernia surgery. That was the only reason that Ziggler was even in that match, let alone the sole survivor. They had the chance. People were still into the guy. They still were cheering for him and rooting for him to succeed. They had the chance to do something with him after that, and they squandered it. And there was no coming back from that. He still had some cult support from the fans. He still had people rooting for him, but they killed him dead by not doing anything with him after that, because they never intended to do anything with him. They were just biding their time until the big dog came back and won the Royal Rumble. You remember that, right? That was that awesome Royal Rumble match from 2015 in Philly. And by awesome, I mean dog shit. Who could forget that dramatic number 30 entrance for Dolph Ziggler, only to be dumped out 2 minutes later like a sack of garbage by Kane and Big Show? The way that Kane and Big Show tossed out Bray Wyatt like that, the way that Kane and Big Show tossed out Dean Ambrose like that. What a great finish to that match, huh? It was amazing. It really was amazing. They actually thought, think about this. I want you people to think about this very, very carefully, okay? They thought that by eliminating Daniel Bryan early in the match the way they did, he came out, he was in there. I don't even know if he was in there for 10 minutes. They thought that by doing that, the fans would get all of that booing out of their system early. And that by the time that Roman came out, and that by the time Roman won, they would be all booed out. Didn't work out that way. They booed the entire rest of the match. They screwed every single person over in that match who came out from Goldust on after Bryan got dumped out of that match. And one of the few times they did not boo in that match was when Ziggler came out. I'm guessing when Ambrose came out, they probably cheered Ambrose because Ambrose is popular too. But when Ziggler came out at number 30, there weren't groans. He didn't get boos the way that Rey Mysterio did the year before when it wasn't Daniel Bryan in that spot. All of a sudden, the crowd came alive and they cheered for Ziggler. One of the very few times in that match, they did not boo. They had "Let's go Ziggler" chants going. And then he gets hit by a right hand by Big Show. Remember that? He came off the top rope. Big Show punched him right in the face, knocked him out, and gets dumped out. What a night that was. The night they put the nail in the coffin. But he makes a great point. If they want him to be the gatekeeper for guys like Bobby Roode when they come up, how is anybody supposed to take him seriously as a threat if the guy loses all the time? I mean, where's the drama in that? There is none. There's no drama. But I'm sorry. You know, when his last deal was up, which was, I think, a couple of years ago, when his last deal was up, he should have been smart enough to see the writing on the wall and leave. He chose to stay. That was his choice. Whether it was the money, whether it was the exposure, whether it was the fear of the unknown, I don't know. Maybe he just was genuinely having fun at the time and had friends and didn't want to leave. I can't get in the guy's head. But he stayed. So what do you expect? He's been around 11 straight years. It's like people say to me, do you think Kofi Kingston one day could be WWE champion? I think if New Day ever breaks up, man, Kofi, he deserves a big singles run. You know what? Yeah, it'd be kind of nice to see how he is in that role. I almost think heel Kofi in that role would be an interesting thing to see how he, you know, if he could pull it off. But it doesn't matter because Kofi Kingston's in the same boat. Kofi's been around for about 10 years straight. He's never been seen in that role. They remember the whole thing with Randy Orton back in 09? That was the closest we ever came to Kofi Kingston getting a big singles push, and that got squashed real quick. That got snuffed out. But now the guy's been around for so long, I don't see it ever happening. It's not going to happen. Because when you're around for that long, you end up, it's almost like, what's the purpose of a screensaver on your computer, right? Think about the very first time you bought a computer. Yeah, I used to have the old Windows screensaver with the little Windows icons flying around. And I'm like, well, why do I need a screensaver for? And they're like, well, you know, because you don't want the image, if you leave your monitor on, you don't want the image to sort of just burn in there. You don't want the burn-in effect, so you have a screensaver. It's like, oh, okay. These guys are like screensavers. They've been there for so long. They're so burned into that role, you can't undo that. People see them at a certain level. They see them in a certain spot. You can't just say one day, hey, let's make Kofi Kingston the world champion. They did that with Jinder. Jinder for so long was, you know, he was an enhancement guy, and they made him champion. And you know what? That didn't work out too well. Jinder is better off for it. He's a bigger star now than he was a year ago. But I would hardly call his title run a success. So you can't just snap your fingers one day and say, hey, you were doing this. You're in this role. Now we're going to put you here. When you're around for that long, 10, 11, 12 straight years, it's hard. It's hard to shake that. Going away, you know, in that quote, Dolph said, I don't know what to do. Do I tweak my act? Do I go away? Yeah, go away, Dolph. Go away. Get them to send you to NXT. Or when your deal is up, leave. Like Cody left. Leave. Go do something else. Go work somewhere else. Dolph could be one of those guys who goes away for 2-3 years, actually becomes a bigger name, and actually has some buzz around him again, and maybe one day comes back like Drew McIntyre did in NXT. He was the champion. Drew was a job guy. The last time we saw him in WWE, he was a job guy. He was wrestling Hornswoggle in WLC matches. But he went out and he remade himself and he came back a bigger star. And it sucks he got hurt. But when he comes back, eventually he'll be on Raw or SmackDown. He'll be a much bigger star than he was before. That could be Dolph. Dolph's not that old. Go away. Go away. And I tell you right now, that is the best possible thing he could do. Because there is no other role for him on this show right now. And he knows it.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Last week, I said there was no new update on Drew McIntyre's injury from TakeOver. The very next day, we got that update, and it's not good. His test results showed a torn bicep, which happened on the final spot of the match against Andrade Cien Almas. He's since had surgery to reattach it, and he's aiming to return in time for WrestleMania weekend, which may be a little ambitious. Typically, that's a 6 to 9 month recovery. Mania would be about 4 months. But everybody heals differently. Wrestlers do have pretty miraculous healing powers, mutant healing powers sometimes. Given his injury, William Regal announced 4 singles matches to take place over the next few weeks, with all 4 winners then meeting in a fatal 4-way. There we go again. It's just amazing. All these fatal 4-way. It's unbelievable. It's hard to believe they once had a pay-per-view called Fatal 4-Way. Just bring it back. Why not just bring it back? So they're going to have a fatal 4-way then to determine a new number one contender for Andrade's championship at TakeOver Philadelphia in January. So the matches are Cassius Ohno against the Velveteen Dream, Aleister Black against Adam Cole, Killian Dane of Sanity against Trent Seven, which is kind of random, and Roderick Strong against Lars Sullivan. Now, I know that some of you have seen the taping results from this week. I am aware of who they've crowned as the new number one contender. I will not talk about it here. There will be no spoilers here. I will wait until it airs to discuss it. But I will say, if you see the list of 4 matches here that Regal has announced, it does not jive with the results, which tells me that they're probably going to shoot an angle on TV to help explain that a little. To help explain that little discrepancy. Otherwise, this doesn't really make any sense. But I assume that's what they're going to do. Did they go with my idea that I pitched on the podcast? The person I pitched for the next title match, that being Johnny Gargano, before doing the Aleister Black match over WrestleMania weekend, that was my prediction. And actually my suggestion more than my prediction that with, you know, McIntyre going down, you need a challenger for January, and why not build up Johnny Gargano? He's been on a losing streak. People, you know, are really behind this guy. They want to see him do well. They want to see him succeed. And if Tommaso Ciampa was okay enough, because he still may not be able to come back until March or April, but if he's physically okay to do a run-in to cost Gargano at the very last second, cost him the championship, you talk about a way to put heat back on that feud, there you go. So that was my suggestion. Save the Aleister Black match with Almas for New Orleans. Did they do that? Are they going to do that? Or are they going to go maybe with Black over Royal Rumble weekend instead, or somebody else? We'll see. We'll see. I'll keep this a safe zone until then. No spoilers here, but I'll talk about it in a few weeks. Also, people noticed this week that Leo Rush had removed all references to WWE and NXT from his Twitter bio, even though his pinned tweet this entire time has always been the announcement from Triple H about his signing with NXT. I didn't buy that as a good enough reason to think that that meant the guy was shit-canned, but that was a good enough reason for a lot of other people and some websites to run with the story that he was released. And then later that night, in the ultimate troll job by WWE at the NXT show in Lakeland, Florida, who should show up but Leo Rush, who I don't believe had wrestled at all since the Emma tweet. This may well have been his very first show back, of course, the very same day that these rumors, all these rumors and reports were floating around. There he is that night on the NXT show. And not only did he wrestle, he won his match. So a lot of people look really stupid by the time that that day was over. He's been on ice, though, like I said, ever since the Emma tweet. Clearly he's being punished in some way or held back, as he should. I mean, look, there are ways to punish the guy without firing him. I never advocated firing him. I think to fire him over the tweet would have been incredibly stupid. So unless there's some other reason to get rid of the guy, you know, you don't fire him. You just sort of put him on ice for a while. And when things cool down a little bit, you start to work him back into things a little bit. But it's going to be a while before we see him, I think, either back on TV or doing anything meaningful. I still would not put it past them to put him in the Royal Rumble match. I kind of said that jokingly a few weeks ago, but I could see it. You know, they have an NXT star or two every now and then show up in the Rumble. And, hey, Leo Rush, he is a name that I think would get a reaction. I think some people anyway would know who he is. And to put him in there and have him, you know, get beaten around a little bit, I could see that happening. The schedule on the USA Network website has NXT listed to air on USA next, not this week, but next Wednesday, that's December 13th, at 7 p.m. That happens to be WWE week on USA. They have a tribute to the troops airing that Thursday. So they're probably going to be doing WWE programming of some sort on the network every day that week. And it looks like for the first time ever, NXT is going to air on USA Network. And I think it makes for an interesting little experiment to see what kind of audience NXT does on a major cable station. I don't see it doing, you know, the 2.5 million people that SmackDown or Raw would do. But if it had a strong enough showing, I wonder if that would open eyes at USA and if they would come to WWE and say, hey, you know, we want to talk about moving the show onto our network. If WWE would, well, of course they would do it. I mean, they pretty much do whatever they're told. They wanted 3 hours of Raw, they gave them 3 hours of Raw. We're still paying the price for it. So unless it was an error that was made on the website, that's in the listings for next week. This week's show had matches that were taped from the NXT live event at the Aztec Theater in San Antonio, Texas, the night before TakeOver. It's a very intimate, small little venue they have there. It was built around a UK tag team main event with Trent Seven and Tyler Bate challenging Mark Andrews and the UK champion Pete Dunne, who we are now in December, right? This is the first sound-off I'm doing in the month of December. We only have a few weeks left in this god-awful year. Not god-awful for this podcast, god-awful for a lot of other reasons. But what all of this means, I bring this up because we are going to be talking very soon about Match of the Year. Match of the Year candidates. We're going to look back on 2017 and everybody's going to be voting on Match of the Year and Superstar of the Year and Feud of the Year and all this other stuff. So I'm thinking about this just sitting here now, and Pete Dunne against Tyler Bate from that Takeover show in Chicago back in May, I think still has my vote for Match of the Year in WWE. I have to think a little more deeply about this. I did enjoy Brock and AJ at Survivor Series. There have been some other really great matches, but I think that one still sits at the top of my list right now. So unless I'm forgetting a match that I really, really liked that I'm not thinking of at the moment, or unless, you know, Clash of Champions has some amazing match. If Jinder Mahal and AJ Styles go out there and tear down the house, I know, unless that happens, I think Bate and Dunn may end up getting that spot when this year is over. And given how this match ended here on this show, it looks like we may be getting an encore real soon. This was not the match of the year, but this was still fun. Story was Pete Dunne and Mark Andrews did not get along at all. Mark Andrews is a babyface. Pete Dunne is a heel who wins at all costs. That runs completely counter to what Mark Andrews is all about. Dunne really didn't want to have anything to do with him as a partner, but he needed one, so he had to make it work. It didn't work out in the end, though, and Tyler Bate pinned Pete Dunne with the Tyler Driver 97. After the match, Dunne blindsided Mark Andrews with a forearm and laid him out with the bitter end, because he's a dick, and he's very good at it. That was NXT. Let's get to your mailbag questions. If you have them, you can email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Blast through some of these questions here. We got some good ones here this week, too. Joey from Chicago. Did you hear about AJ Styles wanting to retire in the next couple of years? Do you think he'll get any bigger than he already is in WWE? There's nowhere higher for him to go. I mean, he's the WWE champion. How much higher is he supposed to go? Get a nosebleed if he goes any higher. I mean, he's the face of the SmackDown brand, right? He could go to Raw at some point, but why? I mean, Edge carried SmackDown for years. He stayed there until he retired. I mean, that was his show, just like it is now for AJ. The one thing I'd like to see him get before he hangs it up is either a WrestleMania main event or at least the chance to headline Mania in a really big match. The match with Shane was hyped up a lot, but it opened the show this year. I want him to have a more prominent match against, you know, Finn Balor, or against Shinsuke Nakamura, or Brock Lesnar. You know, I want him to have that one classic WrestleMania match that people talk about like a decade from now. Beyond that, again, what is left for him to do? Just maintain. Right? Just be featured in a prominent role on the show. You know, keep having great matches. That's all you can really ask from the guy. You know, I'd be perfectly happy if he just did nothing but that for the next couple of years. And I know he said he wants to retire in 2 years. He wants to stop having to reprimand his kids over the phone when they misbehave and they give their mom a hard time, and he wants to be there to do it in person. He's shot down, by the way, this other ridiculous rumor that was floating around. He went on Twitter and said, like, not true or fake or something, when somebody posted that he was going to retire after WrestleMania next year. That's not true, but he did do an interview. He did an interview with a radio station in Houston when they were in town for Survivor Series, and he said he sees himself maybe having 2 more years. I can remember many years ago hearing Booker T say that he would be retired in the next couple of years. And he wrestled like another 5 or 6 years, I think, after that. I mean, you can run down the list of all the other guys that have said similar things. I don't think AJ Styles is retiring in 2 years. He could say it all he wants. I don't think it's happening. Scaling his schedule back, yeah, probably. But if his body feels good, if he doesn't get hurt, and there's still money to be made, there's no way he hangs it up. No way. You can come back 2 years from now and listen to the show and tell me if I'm wrong. But there's no way that AJ Styles is retiring in 2 years. Not happening. Abby from Tasmania. Is there anything at all WWE can do to help Jason Jordan get over? I think his in-ring work is great, but his promos are horrible. Well, to be fair to him, I think that they're designed to be horrible because he is turning heel. I think that they're really cheesy and just bad because it's just part of the character and what they're doing with him. And I think that that's what they have to do to him to give him the best chance of succeeding. So it looks like they're doing the slow burn to that. The jury is still out on whether it works or not. Zach House of Pain Hulker, who has more potential, he asks, to become a bigger star and a true top guy in the company. Dean Ambrose or Braun Strowman? Thanks for your time and roll on to the Royal Rumble pool coming this January. I can't believe it's been almost a year since that last Royal Rumble pool on our Facebook group. This year, let me tell you something. Zach's going to be running the pool again, I hope, in the Facebook group. We had an insane number of entries this year, like over 2,300 entries into this pool. I think the year before we had like 600 and that was a lot. We had 2,300 plus this year. So now we have to try to top that in January, which I'm sorry to Zach. You know, I'm going to apologize to him right now because I know it's a lot of work. But the work this guy puts into this is just top notch. So thank you to him for that. But anyway, Zach's question, who do I think has the potential to be a bigger star? I think Braun Strowman. I know people are bullish on Dean's prospects as a heel one day if he ever turns, but how far would they really let him go as a heel in today's WWE? How far would they let Dean Ambrose go? I don't know that they would let him go very far. Can he pull it off if they don't let him go like balls out with a real heel turn? Ambrose is very popular, though. I mean, can't take that away from him. He still is very, very popular, but Strowman, I think, call it size or whatever, I think he has more potential to end up being more of a main event guy than Dean Ambrose does. Amin, I'm going to call you Amin. I hope that's the right way to pronounce it, from Zurich, Switzerland. Do you think NXT talents could benefit from an excursion? Like the Young Lions from New Japan, they get sent to promotions like CMLL and Ring of Honor to improve their skills. People from the Performance Center could surely be sent to promotions like ICW, with whom NXT has an alliance. I like that idea a lot. This is actually a really great question, and I like the idea a lot. It runs counter to everything that WWE is about, but many, many years ago, on episode 127 of The Sound Off, So what was that? Probably a good 7 or 8 years ago now. That was the big show that I did where, you know, I talked about my WWE business plan. If Vince got hit by a bus and I took over, and this was one of the things I talked about. And I pitched the idea of a WWE territory system where, instead of just training people in Florida, instead of just having this one place down in Florida where you're training people, you have something similar to the Performance Center out west. So you sort of have Performance Center East. Well, you have something, even if it's a little smaller and cheaper to build, you have something similar out in California. You have something out on the West Coast, and you partner with people that you can trust who run schools in different parts of the world. Like, so Lance Storm, for example, he has the Storm Wrestling Academy. And in the past, Lance Storm has said that WWE wanted him to come in as a trainer, and they wanted him, and he just, you know, he has his own school. He has his own business that he runs up in Calgary. And he's turned out a lot of people that have gone on to sign contracts with WWE. So let's say that sort of becomes their Canadian system in a way. Now, I don't think Lance runs shows up there. I think it's just the academy. It's just the school that he has. But surely he could help get them booked on matches on local independent shows while he trains them. You find somebody similar like that in the UK. And this was before the UK boom. When I first pitched this idea, this was long before the UK wrestling boom came along. Now, like you said, they have partnerships with promotions like ICW, and I think Rev Pro. I could be wrong about that. I don't know if they have any sort of active alliance with them. Find something in Mexico, in Japan maybe Australia. So all of a sudden, beyond the US, you've got anywhere from 4 to 6 different places covered all around the world, including some places like a Mexico or a Japan where there's just this plethora of wrestling talent. It's like fertile breeding ground for future pro wrestlers, and you've got that covered. And the talent, after a certain amount of time in one place, learning that style, they cycle out to one of the other places in another country. So some of the WWE people learning under, let's say, Lance Storm in Calgary go to ICW for a few months, however they see fit to work it. I mean, these guys and girls now, they're getting experience working all over the world. all while under contract to WWE in this scenario. Now they're getting exposure to different styles and things from all over the place. And this isn't a system for like the Drew McIntyres of the world or the Aleister Blacks of the world or anybody like that. I mean, guys who already have experience working in other parts of the world, this is for rookie talent. This is for talent they want to groom that doesn't have the same level of experience that those guys do. These are people that come into the Performance Center cold and maybe don't know what they're doing, and this is new to them. Maybe they're a former football player, whatever the case may be. So I know it's a departure from the idea that you proposed, but it reminded me of that, so I wanted to bring it up again. It may be too cost prohibitive for WWE. I mean, we don't even get pyro anymore. I can't see them wanting to invest in an idea like that. But, I mean, really, aside from having to build, let's say, another performance center out west, I'm not really proposing anything that would cost them millions of dollars. I'm not, you know, not if they're forming partnerships with different schools or dojos or promotions around the world. Now, your idea may be more practical in that they take some of that rookie talent that comes through the performance center. So again, these are not indie wrestlers. These are the stars they're trying to create from scratch who have never done this before. And you send them on an excursion for 3 months, 6 months, a year, whatever it may be. I mean, there are young lions in Japan that go away on excursion for 2 or 3 years in some cases. And for those who don't know what this is, my understanding of the Young Lions program in New Japan is that a young lion is someone who has trained exclusively through the New Japan system. They have their own dojo in Japan where they teach these guys. And some, not all of the guys, but some go on excursion where they live and they work somewhere else for a certain period of time to hone their skills, learn new styles, sort of find themselves, learn more about themselves. And when they come back to New Japan, they're just overall a more well-rounded performer. I mean, look at Naito, right? Naito, the same guy who's probably ending Okada's run as the IWGP champion in a few weeks at the Tokyo Dome. He worked here in the States for a little bit. I think he even had some time in TNA. And then he went to go work in Mexico for CMLL before coming back to New Japan. And he came back and he ended up becoming a much bigger star for it. So I like your idea, but like I said, it runs counter to everything that WWE is about. They want to teach people how to be WWE stars. They don't necessarily want to teach them how to be better professional wrestlers. And I think that's the important distinction to make here. They want you to learn their way. They want you to learn where the cameras are located, where to look and where not to look. So, you know, that sort of thing. But I think you can teach them all of that, but still do something similar to what you're suggesting. Christoph from Belgium. After hearing your opinion about WWE's constant focus on the guy, it had me thinking about something. I don't think ECW ever had one guy that they built around. Sure, you had guys with long-term ECW title runs like Raven in the franchise, but the company as a whole never really marketed one guy as its top star. The ECW title picture always had 3 to 4 guys in it, and at one time, TV champion Taz squashed the world champion Shane Douglas. Tag team champions the Dudleys at one point took out practically the entire roster. Would you agree that ECW never practiced the single-star method, and do you think WWE could benefit from this style of booking? Yeah, I don't think ECW ever had that one person. I mean, they had Rob Van Dam was kind of one of their big names at one point. I don't know if I would ever call him sort of the face of ECW. Tommy Dreamer was sort of always the heart and soul, but I don't know if he wasn't like the guy. Yeah, it was always a collective group of people. Dreamer, Taz, Raven, the franchise, RVD, Sabu, Sandman. I think you're right. And I do think that WWE, you know, they just rely too much on the one guy. You know, it was Cena for many years. John Cena was the one guy. And now Roman Reigns. He is clearly the one guy. Now, they have a lot of big names. I mean, they're pushing Braun Strowman as an example. I actually think they're doing a better job right now at this moment. I mean, talk to me in 6 months. I may feel differently. You know, clearly Roman is the chosen one. Roman is going to the main event of WrestleMania. But at the moment, Braun Strowman is the one who's also getting the big monster, no pun intended, but getting the big monster push. And he's ending some of these shows. So yeah, Roman is sort of their chosen one, but Strowman's getting a big push right now. And over on SmackDown, AJ is the champion. if anything, he's not even being focused on as much as, you know, Owens and Zayn are sort of in this feud with Shane. Shane McMahon is really positioned as the face of SmackDown right now. I call AJ Styles the face of SmackDown, but, you know, Shane McMahon is being positioned as the top star on that brand. I don't know how I feel about that. I like Shane. He's the most tolerable of all of the McMahons. But, you know, at some point, you got to get away from the McMahon BS and focus more on the talent. And I'd like to see more of the focus on AJ, especially since he is the champ. And maybe some of the other stars on the brand as well. Or even bring some new stars over to the brand. But I use the Raw example. Roman and Strowman. Roman and Strowman, it rhymes. They're doing a little bit of a better job, at least, of featuring more than just Roman Reigns right now, and I'd like to see them do more of that. You don't have to have the one guy. You don't have to build everything around the one guy. If you build up two or three different people at that same level, if, let's say, Roman goes down with an injury, you're not stuck. You're not all of a sudden, your back's up against the wall. Oh my God, what do we do? Well, you know what? Plug in this guy. Plug in the other guy, because they've been positioned, believably, as a top guy on the Raw brand, as a headliner, and so you could just plug somebody else into that spot. I don't know why you would want to put all your eggs in just one basket. That never made any sense to me. This over-reliance, we got to find the next guy. Well, the next guy is not just going to, you're not just going to find him. It could be somebody who's on your roster right now who's just not ready, or they're not getting the chance to shine. Right? The next Steve Austin could be in the developmental system for all we know. But at some point, you just got to stop. There's not going to be, you're not just going to find another Stone Cold. You're not going to find another Rock. You don't have to just search for that one person. It's okay to build up two, three, four different people at that level. And they're starting to do a little bit of a better job at that now than they were a few years ago. But I think there are lessons to be learned not only from the old ECW, but even from the late 90s WWE. In 1997, which is, you know, some people say the best year for WWE creatively. I would still say 2000, but I'd probably put 97 right behind it. And if you look at the end of 96, and especially the beginning part of 97, there was this big focus on the championship, and you had the title. I think Bret Hart had the title at the time, although it was going back and forth, but you had Bret, you had Shawn, you had Sid, you had Undertaker, you even throw Vader in there, Steve Austin. All of those guys were believable main eventers. All of them were pretty much at that same level. I mean, Undertaker was around a lot longer and more established than, let's say, Vader was, but you had four or five or even up to half a dozen different guys who were you could conceivably say were the top stars in the company at that time. And maybe Austin wasn't quite there, but he was in that mix. And it was all about the championship. The focus was on the WWE title. And they all had an attitude problem, which is how attitude was born, right? Everybody had an attitude. But that's what they need to get back to. Have that core group of guys that they can draw from, and not just one person. Dylan from Portland, Oregon. What is the point in barring people from ringside if they're still going to interfere? I've been watching wrestling my whole life, and I feel like banning somebody from ringside used to actually mean something, but now it's ignored literally every single time. Well, because nothing matters in wrestling anymore. I mean, nobody takes any of that stuff seriously. How can you? It's like being fired on TV. I'm still amazed the crowds pop for those announcements when they make them, because they have to know that they don't mean shit. Nobody ever gets fired. Nobody ever goes away for longer than a few weeks. And now, if you get fired from one show, everybody knows you'll probably just end up on the other show. So what's the point? There's no consequences anymore. That's why Kevin Owens getting down on his knees a few weeks ago and begging Daniel Bryan not to fire him. Forget the fact that he's a heel. But just use common sense. Why does he even want to work on SmackDown? The show is run by the guy he fought inside of a cage. What makes him think he'll ever get a fair shake on that show ever again? Why wouldn't he want to go to the other show where the guy's sister, who hates his guts, runs the place, or her husband, who helped him win the title last year? Triple H and Stephanie, they rule the roost on Raw. Why wouldn't Kevin Owens want to go to Raw? He should beg to be fired. They should do a storyline where Kevin Owens is going out of his way to do everything possible to get fired. He's doing all of this just audacious stuff, which could be very entertaining, depending on what he does. You know, just he does everything he could possibly think of to get fired, and they won't do it. Because they know that's what he wants, and they know he's going to walk right into Raw, and they won't give in. I'd find that to be more entertaining than him getting on his knees, you know, getting ready to give Daniel Bryan a blowjob on TV. Oh, don't fire me, don't fire me. Like, come on, dude, really? But it just doesn't even make sense from a storyline perspective. So, I mean, look, I still make the mistake, I admit, of trying to make sense of these shows. But it really is an exercise in futility. It really is a pointless exercise. But I still try. I still catch myself sometimes trying to make sense of it. This comes from Ken. If you did not feel obligated to the podcast, would you still be watching WWE on a weekly basis? What a great question. I would say no, but I would say no about Raw. I really don't know about SmackDown. I probably would watch SmackDown week to week. NXT, I would. But Raw, for sure, Raw, I would not be watching Raw on a weekly basis. No. No. I would keep up with what's going on. I would cherry pick the clips from their YouTube channel, you know, stuff that I want to see. Or that if you guys say, oh, you gotta watch this, you know, I would watch it. But week to week, would I watch it? No. I don't think I would. And this is coming from a diehard, okay? I've been a diehard since the age of 4. I don't know if it's just the repetitiveness of the shows, or just the creative, or what it is. But I get it now, man. I get it. I get it when I see an email from somebody that says, man, I only keep up with what's going on by listening to your show. You know, they like wrestling. They probably watch NXT or Ring of Honor, or they keep up with the big New Japan shows. But they just can't watch 5 hours or 6 hours of WWE programming every single week. I get it now. I mean, I would keep up with the main storylines, but I would do it in a way that fits into my schedule. I rarely watch Raw live anymore. And I used to be the guy like, it's live, I don't want to be spoiled, I got to be in front of the TV at 8 o'clock. If it's 8:01, I'm all, you know, pissed. I mean, that used to be me. It was must-see appointment TV, even long after it really was must-see TV. I don't know that Raw's been must-see TV in 20 years. But for me, even well after, you know, the late 90s and the early 2000s, it was always, all right, it's 8 o'clock or it's 9 o'clock, got to watch Raw. And I just don't have that feeling at all anymore. Most weeks, I don't watch it live. Unless there's like a really, really big show and I want to like interact with you guys and live tweet during the show, then I kind of have to watch live. But most weeks, I don't care. I just don't care. I watch it later that night. I condense those 3 hours down to one. It's great. Or I just watch the show another day. The urgency that was once there, oh, you know, it's live, I gotta know what happens in real time, it's just not there anymore. Or I'll watch the show, let's say it goes on at 8 o'clock, I'll watch the show, but then by 9 p.m., or like 9:30, so like halfway, I'm done. I'm done. I just can't anymore. So I'll watch the rest of it online without the ad breaks, probably the next day. You know, I'll rip it and put it on my phone and watch it on the way into work. However is most convenient for me. Some segments I may not get to at all. I only review the stuff that I watch. So if I review the entire show, it means I watch the entire show. If I only watch the key stuff, then I will review the key stuff. You won't ever find me reviewing a segment that I didn't watch. That's stupid. And if I didn't see it, I'll tell you that I didn't see it. But I think the show finally broke me at the beginning of the year. And it wasn't anything specific. It wasn't like any one segment. Although that Alexa Bliss, This Is Your Life stuff from earlier this year with Bayley, I could see that breaking me. But it was around the beginning of the year. That's when it happened. It finally broke me. So you just adjust your viewing habits. That's all. I'm still a fan. I'll always be a fan. I love talking about it. I love doing this podcast now more than I ever have. So I adjust. Because if I don't, I'll totally burn myself out. And I just don't want that to happen. Courtney from Seattle. Buy or sell on the better Undertaker Brock Lesnar Hell in a Cell match. Biker Taker and Brock at No Mercy 2002. Or the Dead Man and the Beast at Hell in a Cell in 2015. You know, I pulled Courtney's question because when I first saw it, I wasn't even going to include it because my first thought was, well, this is a no-brainer. I'm going to buy on 2002. This is easy. But then I thought about it a little bit more and I was like, you know what? Let me go back and just watch the match from 2015 again. So I actually watched it. I brought it up on the network the other day at night, and I watched the most recent Hell in a Cell match they had, and it was better than I remember it being. And when I reviewed it in 2015, I think I had positive things to say about it, but I don't know. I mean, it all these things sort of blend together for me now. I had to go back and just watch the match again, and I enjoyed it. And it was a lot of bells and whistles, and they use weapons and all that kind of stuff. They're both older. Undertaker, a lot more so than Brock, and not moving around nearly as quickly and as easily as he once did. But it was a hell of a match. I'm still sticking with my answer, though. I'm going to buy on their 2002 match. I'm going to sell on the one from 2015. But I like the one from 2015. It had blood, which you don't see too much these days. They had some cool spots, like Brock ripping up the canvas and exposing the plywood underneath. Kicking Undertaker in the dick before the finish as payback for what Undertaker did to him. I thought that was quite poetic. It was a really good match. And the story building up to it was much better than their 2002 match. I'll say that much. The build behind the 2015 Hell in a Cell was, you know, twice as good, at least five times as good, as the build to their 2002 match. But as a match, I can't vote against the one from 02. I mean, in that match, they were younger, they were faster. It was an absolute bloodbath. I mean, if you're into blood and gore and all that kind of stuff, I mean, the mat was drenched in Undertaker's blood. You know, for the blood that was in the 2015 match, there was a lot more in that from both of them, but more so Undertaker. He was just bleeding like a stuck pig in that match. And I love that finish in the match from 02 with Lesnar. He reverses the tombstone and he turns it into an F5. He sort of pops Undertaker up onto his shoulders and hits the F5 for the win. For a guy, let me tell you, for a guy who only debuted in April of that year, so he wasn't even there a full year, they sure did live the gimmick with him. The next big thing was not just the tagline. It was not just the catchphrase for Brock Lesnar. It was the very definition of his push. In 2002, in the span of 3 months, think about this, in the span of 3 months, he beat Hulk Hogan, The Rock, and The Undertaker. And he won the WWE title, and I think he was only, what, 23? That's a hell of a first year. It's a photo finish between Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle for best rookie year ever in WWE history. Rodney from Tacoma, Washington, do you think Papa Shango would have been a good fit for the Wyatt family given the dark similarities of their characters? And do you think the Papa Shango gimmick was underutilized? I mean, they were dark characters, but the Wyatts were a bunch of country boys who lived out in the woods. Papa Shango was, he's a voodoo doctor. I don't really see them having much in common. As far as whether he was underutilized, I mean, you know, how much more could they have done with him? The guy did a run-in in the WrestleMania main event. He got to rub shoulders with Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior. Now, granted, he almost missed the WrestleMania main event. That's how late he walked out. That's how far off his cue he was. But still, he did a run-in as part of the WrestleMania main event that year. Doesn't really get much bigger than that, does it? He put a voodoo curse on the Ultimate Warrior. He made him vomit pea soup. He wrestled The Undertaker a few times, although I don't know that any of those matches ever aired on TV. I think it was just Coliseum home video matches. But I know they wrestled. He got a WWE title match on TV against Bret Hart. I think it was on that very last Saturday Night's Main Event special back in 92. I'd say Papa Shango actually had a pretty good year for himself that year. Now, you could say that it could have lasted longer, but I think, you know, it's underutilized. I think they did all they could do with him. It wasn't a character that was ever going to be pushed as being world champion or anything like that. And he got to rub shoulders with some of the biggest stars in the company. So I think he did pretty good for himself. Now, there was talk of bringing him back as Papa Shango around 97 or 98. This was like right on the verge of the Attitude Era. It was right around the time he came back as Kama. And they put him in the Nation of Domination. This would have been right before that. There were rumors that they're going to bring him back as Papa Shango. It was supposed to be a more realistic, as realistic as you can be, doing a voodoo character. He was going to wear a mask instead of the face paint. I mean, he's talked about this before. In interviews, he's discussed this. These were actual legitimate plans that were in place. They storyboarded it, the whole nine yards. Like I said, it was going to be a mask instead of the makeup. They shot photos of him in the new gear. I don't know if they're floating around on the internet somewhere, or maybe he has them in his possession. But they decided to go and do the Kane character instead, as, you know, Undertaker's brother. And I guess they didn't want... I guess that was one dark character enough for them, so they did Kane, and Papa Shango never did come back. I do wonder how that gimmick would have worked in the Attitude Era. My guess is he would have ended up as probably like a comedy character, putting voodoo curses on the women and making their bras fall off or something like that. Or putting a voodoo curse on Val Venus and giving him shrinkage. That's something Vince Russo, I'm sure, would do. So that's probably what they would have done with Papa Shango in the Attitude Era. He would have been... I'll tell you what, though. If he did put a voodoo curse on the women and made their bras fall off, he would have been the biggest babyface in the company. Maybe DX could have made Papa Shango an honorary member. So keep sending those questions in, thesolemonster@gmail.com. For those who have asked, I am planning on recording that TV Tracks Q&A, the whole hospital thing and some other stuff, kind of delayed things. I know it's very late, but I have all the questions, and it's just a matter of recording it, and that'll be going up on Trax's channel hopefully in the next couple of weeks. So for those who have asked me about it, it is going to happen. Just be patient. Keep voting in the Wrestling Radio Awards every day. Nominations are still open for Show of the Year and for the Interview of the Year, Male Interview of the Year category. That's on WrestlingRadioAwards.com. I got a new Sound of Gamer up earlier this week, if you missed it. I know there's some Wolfenstein fans, Enemy Territory fans, the old game. I played three different maps in Wolfenstein. Actually, wasn't half bad. Was not half bad. So if you want to check those maps out, it's a 23-minute video. That's up on the YouTube channel right now. I will be back with you next weekend for episode 525. I can't believe 25 episodes deep already. I feel like I just did episode 500. And we're going to be 25 episodes into that next week. As we count down the final weeks of 2017, we close out the year. Hopefully you will close out the year with me. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
Hi, you've reached the law offices of Park, Park, and Park. Chandler and I are not available right now, but Grandma Jenny is stuck on phone duty all week. So please leave your name, number, and a brief message at the tone, and we'll get back to you as soon as we can. We look forward to representing you.
Hey, Joe Park, Solomonster here. Look, somebody slipped me your card and told me if I ever had any legal needs to give you a call. Just wondering, what's your experience dealing with insurance companies?
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
And there was one moron who tagged me in a tweet. He says, "Smarks like everything from Japan." This guy has a picture of The Rock as his avatar, and he's quoting wrestling catchphrases on his timeline, calling other people marks and smarks when you've got another man as your profile picture and you're quoting Psycho Sid. Sit the fuck down with that nonsense. You don't get to sit at the adult table when you spew nonsense like that. Go stand in the corner and face the wall.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.